Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, and I got my co-host here. It's funny, in the little name it says, because I was in the same square with him last time.
Spencer and Casey?
Spencer and Casey. Doesn't matter.
Nobody's watching this anyways. They're just listening.
We got another special guest. How do I say your last name?
Pesapolic.
All right. I didn't want to screw it up.
Rachel Pesapolic. She's famous in the endocrinology world. She's a bone expert.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me here today. I'm excited to talk about one of my favorite topics.
Good, because we wanted to talk about osteoporosis for a little bit. My brother, he's an endocrinologist. I do, of course, family medicine. I have to be aware of it, but it's nice to have a good expert on, because this is something that it's probably not on people's radar. They don't really feel it. They don't, unless somebody screens for it, they don't really know, or unless they have, a fracture of some sort, and then that's how they find out about it. But from a really high level, what is osteoporosis?
What the heck is
it? Yeah, great question.
What is this?
So osteoporosis is really weakened bone quality, and we see that in a few different ways. One is the way that you actually mentioned, which is a fracture, which is what we all identify as osteoporosis. You break a bone, and then that kind of brings you to the diagnosis. But osteoporosis is a silent disease. And what I mean by that is a lot of my patients don't even consider that they have osteoporosis because they don't feel anything. And so it's a diagnosis that we make based on something called a bone density scan, which is where we're really getting your bone mineral density score and we're comparing it to young people. And so you may have your, a family physician, endocrinologist recommends getting a screening bone density scan. And based on where you fall on that bone density scan compared to somebody else who's younger, we determine if you have osteoporosis. But I really loved what you said initially, which is that people don't feel osteoporosis unless they break something. And it's different than when you actually are symptomatic. So when you have symptoms, you know that you want to get screened for something. But this is a silent disease, but so super important, because if you have a fracture, really can affect your quality of life and has an association with death depending on what the fracture is.
Yeah. So what are the recommendations right now? So how do we even know, when should we start looking for this?
That's a great question.
And so, what are the risk factors?
I guess we'll get into
contribute
that.
When
do we start looking for this, and then what are the risk factors? Let's talk about risk factors first. Who's at risk for this?
Sure. So we know when women go through menopause, they have low estrogen levels, and so that puts them at risk for bone loss. So postmenopausal women are at increased risk for bone loss. As you get older, that risk for bone loss and fractures goes up. So those populations, increasing age as well as after menopause, are risk factors in themselves. Then we have a whole other group of all different types of people that are at risk for bone loss. So for example, if you have men that have low testosterone levels for an extended period of time, that can have an effect on the bones. High calcium levels, women may have what we call primary hyperparathyroidism. That's a calcium level that's been high with a high parathyroid level. That can cause bone loss. Also, if you have undiagnosed celiac disease. So, one of the ways that I tend to make the diagnosis of celiac disease is when I have patients that have an undiagnosed anemia and vitamin D deficiency, and then you start working them up and you find out they actually have celiac disease as the cause of their osteoporosis. Extra alcohol use, high caffeine use, inadequate nutrition. So I know both of you are very involved with nutrition. If you're not getting enough calcium and vitamin D, that can also put you at risk for bone loss.
What about body weight, kind of the very thin versus overweight obesity? We talk about obesity on here all the time, but what are those correlations?
Yeah. So we consider within the ACE postmenopausal osteoporosis guidelines, which we put out an update in 2020, we really consider a lower BMI. So in general, less than 23 to be considered a risk factor for bone loss and osteoporosis. We also know if you've had a long history of an eating disorder, anorexia, that can increase your risk for osteoporosis as well. And by the way, on the extreme, the unusual situation where you have a patient that has Cushing's disease, where they're associated with significant weight gain, that's also associated with osteoporosis and fractures.
Now, yeah, I've
we'll
also
have to get
seen
into my little case study as well. We'll tell
well,
you,
I,
tell you about that.
You later. Know, historically, okay. people are under the impression that even like obesity or just you know, higher BMI is helpful for bones, which historically was once thought, but now I've seen a lot of literature. We're learning that obesity, especially like obesity and metabolic disease, like type 2 diabetes, increases risk of, you know, fracture risk, maybe osteoporosis, or at least reduced bone quality and fracture risk. What do you have any thoughts on that?
So you're specifically, I'm sorry, I lost you on my camera
here. Oh, you don't have to see me.
Can you like, hear him?
Yeah, can you hear me?
He looks like a bum. That's all you need to know.
I just don't know where that camera is. Okay.
Like, so type 2 diabetes. I've seen a lot of, you know, with the type 2 diabetes, that, you know, as opposed to obesity being protective, actually some nuanced thoughts on adverse bone quality and fracture risk with obesity, especially like with type 2 diabetes.
Yeah. So I've actually seen some recommendations that when you're calculating out a FRAC score, which is a risk of fracture, that you can use the FRAC score as you can actually substitute in to have diabetes as a placeholder. Because when you do a FRAC score, it does not actually calculate out if you have an increased risk of fracture with diabetes. And we know that the bone quality is impaired in type 2 diabetes. And some people actually recommend doing additional imaging called the TBS score to get a better sense of the bone quality with diabetes patients.
Okay,
so I would agree with you. I think we're often maybe falsely reassured that the BMD is normal in patients that have obesity, but we know that they actually are at higher risk, especially if they have type 2 diabetes.
So yeah, that brings us in. So then how do you screen? When should you start screening? How does that all work? Talk about the FRAC score, all that. What's your approach here?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the current recommendations are really that once you're in your 60s that you start screening for osteoporosis. I have to say within my practice, I tend to see people that are at higher risk. So I'm typically screening earlier. But you're really at, you know, you should be judging whether or not a patient warrants a bone density at 50 years old based on their risk factors. So for example, if you know that there's somebody that they have a low BMI, they have a family history of osteoporosis, they've had a personal fracture before, or if they have inadequate nutrition, those are people I would start screening sooner than the 65 years of age. And with that, you would be getting a bone density scan. Now, I do really want to bring up the point, and I know you both have dealt with this too. You know, patients with osteopenia kind of think that they're in the clear, and they're really not. That is, we know most fractures actually occur in patients with osteopenia, not osteoporosis. So that is really where we should be focusing a large amount of our efforts. So osteopenia, again, is a diagnosis based on a bone mineral density scan, T-score. If you're familiar with that term. So a T-score is really a standard deviation difference, meaning a difference between you compared to younger patients. And we calculate it out by a number. When you hit that number negative 2.5, that's considered osteoporosis. Normal is actually negative 1 or lower, so meaning that it's near the normal range. And then between negative 1 and negative 2.5, that's osteopenia. So these are people that may not have broken anything. They are in a normal they're in a lower bone mass range than osteoporosis, but they're at a high risk for fracture. So we create this score. We calculate something called a FRAC score. And that score, if it reaches a certain threshold, we recommend treatment. So for example, you can go to your doctor. Your doctor says, you have osteopenia, but I think your risk for breaking a bone is really high and you actually need to go on bone medication, even though you don't have technically osteoporosis.
So here's a question for you. And based on, and I think our ACE guidelines that, by the way, for anybody who noticed, she said we put it out. She was one of the authors on several of the recent updated ACE guidelines. I think, at least I do this, and I think our guidelines say, but I know there's some semantic controversy out there. If someone has low bone density, osteopenia, and they have an elevated FRAC score, so they have an elevated fracture risk, because osteoporosis, you know, we always say it's a clinical diagnosis, right? If you have a fracture, you have osteoporosis in that situation. So if you have a high FRAC score and your risk is such that you deserve treatment, do you call that osteoporosis? Because I think our guidelines sort of tell us to do so. So that's what I do. And I just kind of explain that to patients. And And I also explain it in such a way that they're kind of used to also the cardiovascular risk scoring, like to use, you know, to treat with statins to reduce the risk. And I kind of use that as an analogy just because I think they're more familiar with that. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I'll often say osteopenia with high fracture risk. So specifically if that risk over is, you know, you calculate out a frac score, it gives you a risk over 10 years. If that risk is 20% of any major fracture or above 3% of a hip fracture, then you're really at that threshold that you should be treating these patients. And so I'll tell them, you know, that you have osteopenia with high fracture risk and that you should be on bone treatment. But, you know, within the guidelines, we do recommend two different ways that you could actually make that diagnosis. So one way is with that T score of negative 2.5 or lower at any site. And the second way is with that frac score, as well as a fragility fracture. Mm-hmm. And so I think that one major educational point is that if you have had a fracture before, a vertebral fracture, meaning in your spine, a hip fracture, a wrist fracture, a humerus fracture, that's a fragility fracture. And you can make the diagnosis of osteoporosis without a bone density scan. Mm-hmm. And that's important because fracture begets fracture. So if you had a fracture or let's say a wrist fracture in the past year, your risk of a subsequent fracture is extremely high. So you're somebody that needs to be screened as well as treated.
Does it depend on what caused the fracture in the first place?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, obviously, God forbid you fell out of a window. That would, you know, be a very different story than if you tripped over a rug in your living room.
Yeah. Okay. But,
you know, I'll have patients that I'll say, no, I tripped over a rug, but it was a really big fall. I had a really big tumble. The answer is, you know, most people, if they trip over a rug, they don't really break their wrist.
Yeah, right. Okay.
No, that whole context. Yeah. So I think that's an important educational piece.
Now, this is the Docs Who Lift podcast. What's the deal with lifting weights and bone mineral density?
Dr. Pesapolik lifts some weights. I'll tell you that. She's a doc who lifts. Absolutely.
I exercise. That's very true. Very true. You know, I actually have a pamphlet I give my patients from the Mayo Clinic about exercises with osteoporosis, meaning that, you know, you definitely want to do weightlifting. I just try to tell them to avoid very heavy weightlifting, especially given the risk of the load on the vertebral, you know, on the spine to prevent a vertebral fracture. Yeah,
is there data is there data looking at like, hey, if you put a, I mean, I don't think, if anybody's not lift, if first of all, if they have osteoporosis and they just start lifting, they should probably not be maxing out regardless just because they need to get used to the movement.
But, they're not going to load up 300 pounds on the squat rack. However, I will say, just because this is really up our alley, there are studies really supporting the safety and benefits of relatively intense heavy weight training. But that's the thing. Nobody is going to suddenly put on several hundred pounds on the squat rack if they haven't done it. And probably if they had been doing that all their life, I'm pretty sure strength training has pretty good data showing prevention of osteoporosis, which, you know, we might have to kind of touch on that because we certainly would like to help everyone prevent osteoporosis, and there are ways to do that. And, you know, I think you touched on the risk factors like, you know, nutrition, exercise, smoking, alcohol, some of these other things, right?
Yeah. You know, I'll get the question often. I'll have patients with osteoporosis and they'll say, I really don't want to go on treatment. Can I just lift weights instead and do calcium and do vitamin D and come back to you in a year and see how things are? And so also, you know, those things are really important. That's really great that you want to do the weightlifting, that you want to get enough calcium, you want to make sure your vitamin D level is normalized. But we also want to reduce your risk of fracture. And so that's one of the debates, is whether or not you really can reduce your risk of fracture with this. I mean, from you know, the standpoint of a bone density scan, you can increase your bone density about 1-2% by lifting weights. So that's great. But for many of these osteoporosis patients, it's in addition to a recommended bone treatment agent as well.
And it is hard once you already have osteoporosis, unless there was an egregiously like secondary cause, right? Like you said, Cushing's or hyperparathyroidism that gets treated. You know, treating hyperparathyroidism, one of our indications to do surgery for that is if they have high risk of fracture and osteoporosis. So we know that that is helpful, but otherwise it's pretty darn hard to build bone and reduce fracture risk without some, especially some of our newer medications that help build bone, right?
Absolutely. And that's part of why it's so exciting to be treating osteoporosis, is we now have the ability to take patients that have a really low bone mass, put them on a medication, and actually bring them back into an osteopenia range, which is pretty incredible. But they still have osteoporosis, they still have that risk for fracture, but you reduce that risk of fracture significantly. I also did want to, I know we were going to discuss this a little bit, but I did want to mention, you know, just some of the recommendations I give my patients for calcium and vitamin D. Yeah. So, you know, typically less than 50 years old, I say you want to get 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day in your diet. If you can't get it in your diet, then you do want to supplement it. And then above the age of 50, you want to get 1,200 milligrams a day. Diet is the best, and there's many ways to get it in the diet. But if you can't get it in the diet, and you'll find many people have inadequate dietary calcium intake, then you should be supplementing it. I'll get that question. Well, I was told, you know, if I take calcium, it's going to deposit in my artery, so I'm not allowed to take calcium. And, you know, a lot of those studies were on high calcium supplementation. And so we're not talking about high calcium supplementation. We're talking about getting adequate, good amounts of daily nutritional supplementation.
Now, to be fair, though, this is where it gets confusing, I think, for doctors and patients and everything. It seems like, and if you look at some of the reviews, I think even in our guidelines and stuff on the recommendations, the data, it's a little bit disappointing and confusing, right? With the calcium supplementation, vitamin D supplementation, you know, everyone's talking about the recent data that came out of the VITAL trial. Now, that's not in patients with osteoporosis necessarily, but, you know, it's certainly sort of squashed a lot of the enthusiasm for it. I think it has supported the nutritional calcium, like you noted. Like everyone says, let's make sure everyone gets enough calcium from nutrition. The vitamin D thing, I think, you know, people used to be taking way too much, and it's really kind of come back around to this sort of, well, you can get too much and that's not good for falls and maybe even worsens fracture risk. So this kind of very reasonable dosage, if you even need supplementation, it gets confusing.
Probably get some sun during the day if possible.
Yeah.
Maybe lift some weights, get some sun.
Yeah, that's a whole nother podcast for that, all
eat
the vitamin yogurt, D stuff.
Eat some Greek yogurt, right? Yeah. Greek yogurt, some good leafy vegetables, whatever. Yeah.
I shill out a lot of cheese and yogurt to my patients.
Yeah. That's good. I actually give them a list of calcium-containing foods, and many are surprised to see that a lot of the foods, non-dairy, that they eat, actually, as you were saying, you know, kale, dark leafy vegetables have it, vitamin D, fatty fish, right? Salmon, mackerel.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are definite ways to do it, but I think a lot of patients do have inadequate calcium intake and do need to figure out a way to get that.
Yeah, and Greek yogurt today.
And protein too, right? I mean, you know, there once was a thought that protein intake maybe wasn't great for osteoporosis, but the data have come back around and said, well, actually, you need enough protein. You don't necessarily need to take excess or extra, but I think we have an issue with some people at least not getting enough protein, and it's not great for their bones. But
yeah, I would agree. I always ensure that too.
Okay. So from a patient standpoint, so we have mostly patients, we have doctors that listen to this too. People that have risk factors, talk to your doctor about these risk factors and whether or not you need a DEXA scan, doing a FRAX score. Is that right?
Yep.
If you have a history of...
FRAX score in the setting of osteopenia.
If you have a history of celiac disease, which isn't that uncommon, probably should get a DEXA scan. Is that the recommendation?
Yeah, so that's a controversial recommendation, meaning that a lot of the major GI organizations recommend getting a bone density 1 year after starting a gluten-free diet. The reason being is that you actually have significant improvement in your bones after a gluten-free diet. So the recommendation is to get one year into it. I actually find that a little challenging because you kind of want to see where you're starting. Mm-hmm. But celiac disease is another one of those examples that your bones get better, really unusual, but your bones do get better because you're starting to absorb all your nutrients, your calcium, your vitamin D. So you do want to get a bone density with celiac disease age as well, and to see if you get some improvement, which you often do.
So if you're pretty healthy, you're not smoking, you don't have, you're not high alcohol, all these other risk factors, what age should you talk to your doctor about getting a DEXA scan? What's that? Is it 60, 65? What are you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, technically, I think a lot of the organizations say 60, 65, but, you know, we say with AIDS, we say, you know, around the age of 50, if you have risk factors, then you should consider getting a bone density scan, especially after postmenopausal. For example, if you're having height loss, right, height loss can be signs of an undiagnosed vertebral compression fracture. And I pick up compression fractures all the time that patients are asymptomatic with. Mm-hmm. So if you have somebody who says that they've lost height over the past few years, or, you know, if you know for sure that they've had inadequate nutrition, those risk factors that we talked about, I think starting around the age of 50 would be reasonable. At least that's what I do in my practice.
So what interesting story. I got a DEXA scan for a body composition, and it showed my T-score. It was like negative 2 point something. I was like, what? This thing's wrong. So I got it over. And it also did the...
I got this emergency phone call from him. And I go, what the heck is going on? Yeah, like, this was a few years ago.
And what was it? What's the score that looks at the trabecular, the architecture? We also got that. It looked bad.
The trabecular bone score? That's what you said earlier, TBS. Yeah,
the TBS. Yeah. It looked not good. And I was like, this thing's wrong. So I did it again, got another one at the Naval Hospital, and it was like, wow, this looks right. And as your friend, Dr. Clifford.
My buddy, who's still in the Navy.
In the first place. So I was like, no, you got to do a full workup. I'm lifted all my life. This makes no sense. And so what happened was we checked my Cushing's. I've been checked for celiac so many times. In fact, I had an intestinal biopsy before. I have Hashimoto, so I'm at risk for celiac. That was negative. What happened?
He's also
is
a hypochondriac.
Well, I am, but because of these weird things.
I was going to ask your age to use that in my calculation, but I thought maybe you don't want to share that.
Yeah, so. No, I'm 38, and so turns out I was peeing out a lot of calcium, so I have an idiopathic hypercalciuria. I'm on chlorothalidone.
Wow.
Yeah. We have been monitoring. My bone density keeps going up. So I guess the question, like, I've done head surgery on my arms and everything else, you know, I've never had fractures.
I was going to say, you've never had a fracture that I recall.
And I've fallen and wrestled and whatever, so I lift a lot.
And the question is, you've never had kidney stones, by the way. So,
no, well, I got an ultrasound, though. I got an ultrasound.
Oh, you did have one in that, didn't you? Yeah.
But I just got another ultrasound, and they were like, you don't have a kidney stone. I'm like, I definitely did not shoot out a kidney stone any time in the past few years.
Well,
but a few years ago, it showed a 0.6. I don't know. It was weird. Anyway. Yeah.
And you don't have primary hyperparathyroidism,
no,
right?
No, I've checked multiple times.
I see a lot of hypercalciuria when I, because I screen a lot of patients for this. I'll bet you do too, Rachel.
Selfishly, I'd be like to know, like, I think I could show you my most recent scores. It was like a year ago. I kept getting decks. I'm like, please keep checking.
No, but
please.
You made an important point, which is based on your age, though, we're really using a Z-score with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when they did the normative data, they're not looking at people that are 38-year-old men for a bone density. They're looking at 50-year-old women, right? Yeah. So
it was low bone density for age is what we call it when it's not somebody over 50, right? So as I recall, Spencer, your Z score was like -2 point something. As I recall, it was low bone density for age. So that for everyone listening, this gets into some nuance of bone density stuff, but
But I'd be interested, like, do you have these hypercalciuria patients? Do they get much better on chlorothalidones? For those who listen, chlorothalidones, a thiazide diuretic, it's usually for hypertension. The side effect is one that it actually inhibits calciuria. It actually increases calcium in your blood because it stops the secretion or whatever. So, do you get those patients in your...
Yeah, I do, because you wind up finding a secondary cause that is treatable. I also always make sure that they're not dumping too much sodium into their urine whenever you have somebody with hypercalciuria, because that can also impact your assessment of it. So I don't know if they check the urine sodium.
Yeah, we did
a
bunch of things. I'm taking potassium citrate as well, just because of the chlorothalidone now.
Yeah.
But have you seen improvement with the chlorothalidone treatments, or do you need to put these people on bisphosphonates?
Definitely have improvement. I often find, you know, simultaneously I'm treating their osteoporosis, but you're young, you know, I'd like to see what you do with follow-up on this.
Well, if I get a fracture, I'm suing you. I'm just kidding.
It's a little different for you, because like she said, a lot of our patients that get referred to us are all, you know, they have osteoporosis, they're of the age of osteoporosis, they're postmenopausal. We happen to diagnose this underlying secondary cause, but then they're still getting the other treatment. When we see people like you, where it's like, we're really looking for a secondary cause because you are not someone who's at
weird.
Risk.
I was like,
that's where we see the most benefit, I think. I mean, I do get a lot of patients like this. I treat a lot of primary hypercalciuria, it seems like. Maybe I'm just looking for it a lot.
Yes, me too. Yeah, listen, it reminds me of, you know, at the age of 5, I screened my daughter for celiac because my husband has celiac, and she came back positive, but asymptomatic. And I was like, why did I look? What was I looking for, right? And now you have a diagnosis.
Yeah.
But I think your case is a good one that you're going to be able to treat, really.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we need to do another podcast sometime on
the treatments.
On the treatment of, I mean,
I have to tell you, the treatments are so exciting. I think they get such a bad rap for, you know, the potential joint issues and fracture. But I mean, to be able to treat osteoporosis now is a totally different ball game than Fosamax 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's all we had before. It's like, take your Fosamax. Yeah.
Well, and female hormone therapy, postmenopausal hormone therapy we have, you know. But, and that's come back around, you know. We have more data on
it
that. And but you're right that they they get a bad rap. And so out there, you know, one, we have a bunch of quacks that try to, you know, scare patients away from good therapies, right? And then, but also the dentists often are like more scared of it than they should be. And I don't want to sound like an anti-dentite, like on Seinfeld, you know, remember the anti-dentites that they talk about? Anyways, all right, whatever. But you know, they if any dentists are listening, certainly, I think the next podcast we'll talk about therapies and hopefully reduce some of the maybe unwarranted fears, but acknowledging, you know, the actual issues that are there, I suppose.
Yeah, I think knowing the exact data as far as what the actual incidence is and how it increases with the amount of time you're on these medications, which is why we try to use it for a certain amount of time, reassess, go on a drug holiday, not for Prolia, right?
Right. Well, that's we'll touch that on the next one, because that, I'll tell you, that happens all the time too. You probably get tons of patients who get sent to you, and then this happens with the agents that build bone too, for people listening. There are certain medications that you have to stay on and then follow up with a certain type of medication. And then one called Prolia that she just mentioned, or denosumab, that's an every 6 month subcutaneous shot. It turns out that you have to stay on that or do something different, because we've had people who come to us and they haven't been on it for a couple of years and they lost a lot of their bone density and their fracture risk came back. So,
Yep. And we did find that there is an increased risk for rebound fractures when you do that. So that's why you can never stop that without talking to a doctor first. And on a final note with that, you know, during COVID, I had many patients that unfortunately missed their doses and didn't contact because they just assumed they couldn't get to the doctor. So we're seeing this surge of rebound fractures as a result. So it's terrible. Yeah. So that message is so important. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I think this has been a good intro, basically, you know, understanding the risk factors, understanding when to get screened. And I think we should probably do another podcast on then the treatment of, but I think this is a good one for looking into the prevention and looking for screening and the risk factors. So thank you, Dr. Pasapolek.
Thank you for having me. I follow with you on social media. You're doing great.
Well, now you're going to be part of that. So
You can. Yeah. Awesome. And we'll set one up for a follow up one of these days in the near future.
Very good.
Yes. Hope you all get some vitamin D from the sun today.
Yes.
Sunscreen, mind you. All right.
All right. Hang on.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.